You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
1 year ago this coming Sunday, seems hard to believe, the Tohoku earthquake hit northeast Japan. 9.0 on the Richter scale, the most powerful earthquake in Japan's modern history. It triggered a tsunami, a huge wall of water, 65 feet high in some places, that crashed down on the Japanese coast. At least 20,000 people died in the disaster. Damian Grammaticus of our partner, the BBC, has been back to see what has happened to survivors.
Flapping in the breeze is a Japanese flag inscribed with prayers. Quietly, small groups of people gather here on top of a small mound just a few hundred yards from the seashore where a shrine once stood. And down in front of me is where the town of Yuriage was, home to 7,000, and it's completely empty. All you can see is the grid of streets and the foundations where the homes were, all overgrown with grass. Tatsuya Suzuki brings his children, Hikari, who's 7, and her small brother, Hibiki, to see where their home was. When the tsunami swept through here, Tatsuya Suzuki was at work, his wife Izumi at home. She managed to get the children to safety. Seconds later, she was swept away by the waves.
Every time I think about it, I wish I could go back in time, go back to that day and save my wife. I wouldn't mind if everything else had been swept away, if only I could have saved my wife.
A couple of hours up the coast from Yuriage, on a little inlet, stood the pretty village of Okawa, complete with its school. Now, there's just a muddy plain here. People come and ring a prayer bowl at a shrine that's been set up in front of the gutted remains of the school. Because of 100 children who used to study here, 70 were swept away. Right next to the school and by the seashore are teams of men in blue uniforms with mechanical diggers and hand shovels, working through the piles of mud left by the tsunami. They're still searching 1 year on for the bodies of the missing. There are some parents looking on, 4 children are still unaccounted for, and Yasukichi Takayama, still searching for his mother, Towako.
Nothing moves on. I want to find my mother and her bones, but there's been no sign of her. I've been following search teams like this all year. I have no idea what happened. I cannot find any trace of her.
Back in Yuriage, Tatsuya Suzuki brings his children, Hikari and Hibiki, to the small mound overlooking the remains of the town where the shrine once stood. He clasps his hands, bows his head, and says a prayer.
The children don't say mama, mama too much now, but sometimes they cry out suddenly in their sleep. From time to time, I see sadness in their faces. When I see that, I struggle to know what to say to them. My heart aches.
Tatsuya says he would like to come back and live here one day, but his children, he says, have told him they never ever want to live in Yuriage again.
Mind-blowing reporting from Damian Grammaticus of our partner, the BBC. And Damian's work was some of the best reporting on the aftermath of the tsunami in Japan. And our next guest now was our go-to voice to help us understand the other important piece of the disaster. That was the meltdown, of course, of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex. By itself, one of the worst crises in Japan's post-war history. In the years since, Fukushima has produced a re-examination of nuclear safety all over the world. And joining us here to talk about it is David Biello, Associate Editor of Environment and Energy at Scientific American. Welcome to the studio. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
David, let's talk about where Fukushima stands right now, the multiple reactors, the state of shutdown, and the state of the cleanup.
Well, right now, the 3 reactors that melted down during the crisis, they're all in what's known as cold shutdown. That means they're all cool enough to not boil water. And that's really the main thing you want to have happened with a melted down nuclear reactor. As far as the cleanup goes, the Japanese government has committed to cleaning up the entire area surrounding. This is the 20-kilometer exclusion zone. No one's allowed in there. And hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated as a result of the crisis. None of them have come home, and they may never come home. It will certainly take at least decades if the Japanese government does complete a full cleanup to complete it.
And as we were seeing the permanent scars of the tsunami on the north coast of Japan, there are permanent scars related to this this evacuation. As you say, some people will never go home. And there have been reports and some criticism of the Japanese government about the pervasiveness of the contamination even outside the evacuation zone. Where does that stand right now?
That's right. There's a plume of radioactivity that extends about 20 kilometers to the northwest. That appears to have come from a fire that you might recall broke out in Unit 4. Mm-hmm. That was a reactor that wasn't running at the time, but did end up exploding anyway. And that's still a little bit unexplained. And that seems to have spread contamination in that plume. It's going to be really tough to get that stuff out. Essentially, they have to scrape the entire landscape clean and start over.
Unbelievable. We're talking with David Biello, Associate Editor of Environment and Energy at Scientific American. Now, you have an extensive scientific background. Thinking back over the year and over the months, particularly right after the earthquake and tsunami, as you watched the developments at Fukushima, how much did it test your understanding of the science of nukes and nuclear reactors and nuclear power? And how many times were you surprised?
One of the things that I guess is ironically most surprising about this accident is how not surprising it was. Mm. Everything that happened at Fukushima was in some sense predicted, in some cases decades before. Folks who had done analyses of these safety systems had said if they face a significant challenge like they did at Fukushima, they will fail. And they did fail. Like I said, what was most surprising was how unsurprising this was.
Disheartening. David, we talked a little bit about how the cleanup is far from over and it's going to require hundreds of millions of dollars and a lot of very, very unusual cleanup to happen. How much has the safety of nukes been reexamined everywhere in the world, not just Japan?
Pretty much everywhere that either has nuclear power plants or wants to build new ones has conducted a safety review. In Europe, we had the stress tests. Those are still ongoing. In China, they had a pause in their really quite massive nuclear construction program to review the safety programs. The only place that doesn't seem to have done much of a review is, of course, here, the United States. We're still mulling over what we might want to do as far as nuclear power plant safety goes.
Now, why would that be the case, given, as you said in the last segment, that much of what happened at Fukushima was completely anticipated by both the geology and the historical record? What happened was completely predicted.
Well, I guess that's what gives U.S. regulators some comfort. They feel that they have a good understanding of how these reactors work and what the safety challenges might be, and therefore they can be more deliberate in their review of safety. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that's the government agency that oversees nuclear reactors in this country, are engaged in their process of lessons learned from Fukushima, and they're expected to deliver those lessons any day now.
Now, there are multiple variables at the Fukushima Daiichi complex that really led to the disaster here. And I think we can think that regulators may have a sense of the severity of an earthquake, for instance, survivability of a containment structure. Those things are pretty straightforward. But when you add the sudden unavailability of power for backup cooling systems and the failure of backup generators when all of that happened at Fukushima, then you're dealing with a much more complicated equation here. How have regulators dealt with the issue of what if we lose even our three redundant backup systems? Because that's really what happened at Fukushima.
Yeah, that's right. Essentially, defense in depth wasn't deep enough. So the solution has been add more depth. Let's bring in some more portable generators. Let's boost the battery life that can run safety systems. Build more diesel tanks. Let's get more pumps. Let's get hoses into the spent fuel pools. This was one of the surprising things about Fukushima was that the spent fuel pools, this is where the used nuclear fuel is stored after it's kind of had its useful life. Because the buildings blew up, those were suddenly exposed to the sky, as you may recall from the helicopter footage. And that means that, you know, radioactive material was had a direct path, let's say, to the public.
And Japan is actually, I believe, a little ahead of the United States in its permanent disposal of spent fuel. In the U.S., the open pools and the spent fuel reservoirs on site at nuclear facilities all over the U.S. are an order of magnitude, I believe, more than was in Japan. So what is the threat from spent fuel that's undisposed of in the U.S. facilities?
Yeah, that is actually a big problem for the United States. We, as you know, from Yucca Mountain, have no permanent solution for storage of this nuclear waste or a real understanding of what we want to do with it. That means that our spent fuel pools are even more fully packed, because essentially all the nuclear fuel we've used in 40, 50 years of nuclear power are still in the spent fuel pools.
Right.
That means it's really densely packed. And essentially when nuclear fuel is really densely packed, it can start to interact with each other.
Which means a more complicated sort of coolant strategy that needs to be. And let's just remind people, this has nothing whatsoever to do with the reactor. There could be a full-scale nuclear catastrophe at one of these nuclear sites that has nothing to do with the power generator, that simply could be something going wrong at one of these spent fuel pools.
That's right. And the spent fuel pools in the initial conception of nuclear power were not considered to be a major threat, so they don't have kind of major safety systems associated with them. The reactor has this huge containment system, as you mentioned. Spent fuel pools are essentially sitting in that building outside the reactor. And as we saw at Fukushima, those buildings can blow up. And once they blow up, then the spent fuel pool is essentially out in the environment.
All right. So public radio, once again, trashing nukes. Flaky Biello here from Scientific American doing his like anti-nuke screed here. How do you respond to that?
Well, two things. One thing, there is a point that needs to be made, which is that no one has died from the nuclear crisis in Japan. As you mentioned, you know, tens of thousands of people died from the tsunami. No one has died from the nuclear accident as of yet. Two, Japan's greenhouse gas emissions, if you care about climate change, and like you said, flaky public radio, we care about climate change.
No, you were the flake. The public radio listeners, they're not flaky.
Right.
Yeah.
I got you. Right. I'm the flake. Yeah, so we care about climate change.
That's right. Just being clear. Yeah. So you're going to make a pretty important point.
Yeah,
there.
We care about climate change. Japan's greenhouse gas emissions kind of skyrocketed after Fukushima.
Because they had to replace that power.
Correct. All their nuclear reactors were shut down. There are only two operating now, and they've replaced all that with natural gas. And burning natural gas, while better than burning coal, let's say, is still producing greenhouse gas emissions.
Is there any sign that the Fukushima disaster has set back the plan to diminish the use of fossil fuels by substituting nuclear for coal facilities and natural gas and oil facilities?
It certainly has in Japan and Germany. Italy was also considering a kind of major revival of its nuclear program, and that's now off the table. But it hasn't set it back here in the United States or China, which or India, which are the major emitters in the world. And, that, depending on your perspective, is a good thing for climate change or a bad thing for those who fear nuclear power.
Then looking at the map, and again, we don't want to be alarmist here in any sense. And the geology in Japan is unusual. It's a very, very active earthquake zone. And that compounds the sadness and the sense of maybe better precaution should have been taken in a place that is accustomed, if we can say such a thing, to these kinds of earthquakes. Even this one was a record, though. Where would you expect the next accident of this type to take place, and what kind of character would it have? Would it be a negligence incident? Would it be a geological incident? Would it be something to do with the weather?
It's impossible to predict the future,
sure,
as you know, and I don't have my crystal ball with me here today. But
it's
a
where question than a when question.
You got to go with the numbers. It's probably going to be in the United States or France. We have the most nuclear power plants and the most humans operating those nuclear power plants. So the odds of an accident, if one should occur, are most likely to be here or France. Remember, we do have reactors that are very close to fault lines. Here in the United States, in California, there's a nuclear power plant actually sitting on top of a fault line, Indian Point.
Diablo Canyon,
correct.
In California, Indian Point here
in
New York.
Indian Point is not too far from an earthquake, and we just had a nuclear reactor survive a a large earthquake down in Virginia, the North Anna plant. Now, it came through with flying colors, so, you know, that's a good thing.
And, of course, aging technology, unlike some of the developing world countries who are using much more modern designs for their reactors. David Biello, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
David Biello, Associate Editor of Environment and Energy at Scientific American. You can get back to tweeting now. Thanks.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.